This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Peter Mayers here with you in the National Interest on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, or as audio from our website. Today on the program, we wade into the debate about foreign workers on temporary visas. We discuss the stolen wages of Aboriginal workers in Queensland, and we hear from a retired physicist who's tinkered around in his backyard and found a way to purify water using the rays of the sun. The National Interest News Roundup this week kicks off in the Sydney suburb of Manly, where Mayor Peter McDonald wants to go the way of Singapore and free his municipality from the global plague of chewing gum. Manly's mall, the Corso, is being relaid with two-tone granite pavers designed to reduce the unsightliness of chewing gum stains and specially treated for easy cleaning. But this might not be enough to keep the pavers pristine, so Mayor McDonald is asking local traders to stop selling gum as well. Unlike smoking, skateboarding, bike riding, rollerblading and drinking alcohol, chewing gum won't be banned altogether. So there'll be no body searches as you disembark from the ferry from Circular Quay. "Chew it to your heart's content," says the mayor, "but then stick it behind your ear and take it away with you when you leave." In other news from the harbour city, Sydney hotels are openly flouting the partial ban on smoking in pubs. The Sydney Morning Herald surveyed 16 watering holes and found half of them in breach of the regulations. Hotels have been required to restrict smoking to half of the area of their licensed premises since July last year. But since then, not a single pub has been penalised for breaking the rules, even though there have been more than 400 complaints lodged. New South Wales is also having trouble finding new police officers. In March, Premier Maurice Yemma announced a plan to boost the ranks of the local constabulary by 750 officers before the end of the year. But the Daily Telegraph reports that 6 months of recruiting interstate and overseas has produced just 5 applicants, and so far only one new bobby on the beat. During the same period, 23 officers have left New South Wales after being snapped up by the Federal Police or heading over the border to Queensland. The Herald Sun reports that Melbourne University has restricted library access to books recently banned from sale by the Classification Review Board. The books, Join the Caravan and Defence of the Muslim Lands, were banned on the basis that they incite terrorist acts. Both texts and a third book by the same author have been removed from the general access shelves in the Uni Library. However, Attorney General Philip Ruddock says researchers and lecturers are still able to refer to the material in teaching an academic understanding of militant Islam. The Financial Review reports that socialism's days are numbered, even at the Fabian Society. For 60 years, the Fabians have committed themselves to furthering socialism and the education of the public in socialist principles. But this doesn't sit too well with the Society's current National Secretary, state ALP candidate and dot-com millionaire Evan Thornley. Mr. Thornley's written to members proposing new wording. He suggests the Fabians should henceforth commit themselves to a society in which true equality of dignity and opportunity exist for all. Finally, a response to last week's interview with Tom Bentley, the former director of the Demos think tank in the UK, who's taken up a job with the Victorian government. Listener Simon wrote in to say that I twice referred to Tom Bentley as having a job in the Premier's office, when in fact he is a senior public servant in the Department of Premier and Cabinet. The difference between policy and political advice has been dangerously blurred by the Howard government, writes Simon. So it's disappointing to hear serious media who should know better ignoring this crucial distinction. Coming up, the contentious 457 visa to bring in temporary workers from overseas. Nothing arouses the passions like a temporary foreign worker. The ALP and the unions have been mounting a campaign against the growing use of the so-called 457 visa, claiming the federal government and employers are using the visa to exploit guest workers on cheap wages, rather than investing in the training and skills of young Australians. The Immigration Minister, Senator Amanda Vanstone, has hit back. She accuses the opposition of playing the race card when it complains about temporary workers coming from Beijing, Beirut and Bombay. Joining me to discuss the 457 visa are two researchers who've reached different conclusions about what's going on with temporary workers in Australia. Bob Kinnaird is an independent migration and labour market analyst who's looked at the 457 visa for the journal People and Place. He joins me from the ABC studios in Sydney. Bob Kinnaird, welcome to the National Interest.
Hello, Peter. Thank you.
And on the phone from Canberra is Dr. Siu-Ann Koo, a demographer at the Australian National University and the co-author of a study commissioned by the Immigration Department to track the experiences of temporary workers in Australia. Siu-Ann Koo, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
Now,
I'd just like to make a correction that our survey was not commissioned by the Department of Immigration. It was actually funded by the Australian Research Council.
Okay.
With the collaboration of the Department of Immigration.
All right. Well, my apologies. I guess the reason I thought that is that the Immigration Minister, Amanda Vanstone, has used your research findings to defend the 457 visa, saying that 93% of the workers were professional or skilled workers with an average salary of $65,000 a year. Is that a fair conclusion for her to draw from your research?
Yes, our research certainly showed a profile of the 457 visa holders that's very close to the profile that we get from the department's settled arrivals information and visa grants to people on 457 visa holders. But it was a study that was funded by the Australian Research Council with the Department of Immigration as a collaborative research partner.
And it's on the Immigration Department's website. I mean,
That's
the Immigration
right.
Department is obviously very pleased with this research.
Well, it was conducted several years ago. It wasn't a very recent study. We began the study in the beginning of 2003, and we completed it last year, although we're still analysing the data for academic papers that we're publishing in various journals. But it's a study that was carried out about 2 years ago.
And the huge majority of the foreign workers you surveyed were very positive about their experiences in Australia, and they believed they were learning useful skills and passing on useful skills.
That's right. That was one of the findings from the survey. The 457 visa holders were generally very pleased with their work experience in Australia. They felt that they were passing on their skills to Australian workers. They enjoyed living in Australia, and a very large proportion said that they intended to apply for permanent residence.
Bob Kinnaird, the Labor Party has been busy putting your research around, I think even distributing it in the background at one of Senator Vanstone's press conferences. Do you have an affiliation with Labor?
No, Peter, I don't. I only found out about that distribution of my report by the Shadow Minister for Immigration after it happened. I don't object to him distributing it because I'm interested in getting my research and information about the 457 visa as widely known as possible, but I'm not associated with the Labor Party in any way. And in fact, if you have a look at my research, as I think you've seen, I point out that the Labor Party actually initiated the 457 visa back under the Keating Labor government in 1995-96.
Well, ironies abound in this debate. I mean, one of the largest users of temporary visas are, in fact, state Labor governments, especially to import nurses and doctors for hospitals. And as the Minister, Immigration Minister Amanda Vanstone's pointed out in Parliament, trade unions have actually used the visa to bring in staff from overseas. And while the government is attacking the opposition for its racist response to these visas, the Prime Minister has also been very quick to point out to voters that, in fact, most temporary workers don't come from China or India. He wants them to know they come from the UK.
Yes, I noticed those comments. Now, the Prime Minister is 100% correct in pointing out that the largest single group of 457 visa holders do, in fact, come from the UK, about 27% or so. The point about the 457 visa, though, is really not so much the origin, the country of origin of persons, although that is important in one respect, which I'll come back to in just a minute. But the really important question is whether or not the 457 visa scheme undercuts local market rates and whether it has an impact on, a negative impact on training of Australians. To my mind, they're the two major issues. There's also wrapped up in that the very important humanitarian issue of whether the visas exploit foreign workers, and by foreign workers here, with appropriate apologies, etc., to Senator Vanstone. By foreign, I mean persons who are not Australian citizens or Australian residents.
Siyuan Koo, that issue of whether the 457 visa is undercutting wage rates in Australia or being used to bring in people rather than train Australians, that's really not an issue covered by your research, is it?
We did look at that in our study, and it was not clear that there was any undercutting in terms of wages. We asked people what their annual average income was, and the results we get look quite reasonable to us. Managers were fairly well paid. Those with technical skills were not as paid as highly. But there was no indication in our study that 457 visa holders were unhappy with their work conditions. They had the opportunity to tell us whether there was any dissatisfaction with their work experience and living in Australia. And the main issue that we get from them about which they were dissatisfied was about their application for permanent residence visas. Many of them were very unhappy about the lengthy procedures and the when they tried to apply for permanent residence. That was the dissatisfaction that came through in our study. There was no indication that there was any unhappiness with their work conditions.
Are you satisfied that your survey accurately captures the full range of 457 visa workers? I mean, it was done in English, it was done, the follow-up survey was done by email, and it seems that there's a weighting in your survey in favour of English-speaking migrants as opposed to, say, to migrants from China or Korea or Southeast Asia, and perhaps a weighting to the professions rather than the trades.
We looked at the country of origin of the 1,200 or so respondents to our surveys, and we get a very good representation from people from China, Korea, and from India. So we don't think that there's underrepresentation in terms of people from non-English-speaking countries.
And what about professions versus trades?
We did get quite a good representation of all the professions and trades. We got about nearly half professionals, but we did get 6% in trades occupations. And among the trade occupations, you know, we get carpenters, joiners, electricians, and motor mechanics. So we were very pleased with the occupational spread when you look at the exact occupations of these people.
Bob Kinnaird, the trades, though, are they appear to be growing in importance in this scheme. I mean, originally it seemed to be more IT workers and health professionals, but the use of the 457 visa in construction, meatworks, manufacturing seems to be growing.
Yes, Peter, that's right. We can't say with 100% certainty what the numbers are here because, as with so many things about the 457 visa, the government or the Department of Immigration refuses to release the figures. Here we are in middle of September now, and there's been no release by the Department of Immigration of an occupational breakdown of the visa figures, 457 visa figures for 2005-6, nearly 3 months ago. And that's after a 42% increase in the last financial year in the number of visas.
Yeah, we had last year 40,000 visas issued to skilled workers, which with their dependents means 70,000 people coming in on that visa. That was up, as you say, 40% on the year before. And
that's right.
It had grown 25% the year before that. So it is a dramatically expanding part of our migration program.
That's right, it is. And for the first time in 2006-07, this current financial year, we're probably going to have more temporary skilled visas, 457 visas, issued than we are going to have permanent skilled visas under the General Skilled Migration Program. And that's a major milestone in immigration development because it's pushing Australia more in the direction of a US-style immigration program where temporary migration legal temporary migration I'm referring to dominates over skilled permanent migration.
Siew Ann Khoo, we've received from the Immigration Department a breakdown of the visa grants for last year by sector, that is construction,
that's
manufacturing,
right.
Transport and so on. But do you think overall there is enough transparency in this visa, given how important and how quickly it's growing in Australia?
From our experience researching the visa, I think that the department's been quite transparent about it. From the time that the visa was implemented in 1996, we had no problems getting statistics from the department to look at the characteristics of the visa holders, and they regularly publish in the department's annual population flows publication in terms of their country of origin, industry breakdown, occupation. So that, I think that's enough statistics to track the trends in the numbers of 457 visa holders.
And Bob Kinnaird, then what's the problem?
Well, I disagree with Siew Ann that the department publishes enough information about 457 visa holders, and in particular the crucial information. The information that Siew Ann Khoo referred to as being in those Department of Immigration documents, for one thing, it comes out months after the actual event, in some case nearly 12 months. Secondly, information on salaries that DEMA approves for 457 visa holders has never been published by the Department of Immigration at all in the 10 years that the visa program has been running. And as we all know, that's one of the most contentious issues. And thirdly, while I'm glad that Siew Ann King has had no trouble in getting, has had no trouble in getting information from the Department of Immigration, I certainly have. More than 12 months ago, for example, the Department of Immigration gave an undertaking in writing to me that they would supply me with information on 457 visa holders in IT occupations, including their salaries for 2004-05. Now, they have reneged on that commitment. They've told me they're not going to provide it. And I noticed that yesterday the Minister for Immigration was proudly boasting how open and accountable and transparent her department is and how pleased they are to engage with critics.
You have particular concerns about the IT sector, don't you, and the effect of this 457 visa on the computing sector?
That's right, I do. That's the area of the 457 visa holder that I've studied most intensely. And to give them their due, the Department of Immigration up until last year was quite willing to hand over information about that to me.
But the problem, what are your key concerns?
The key concerns about the IT area in 457s are that the visa grants in IT were actually increasing during a period of downturn in the graduate labour market, in particular in Australia. Over the period 2001 to 2005, we had record levels of graduate unemployment amongst Australian graduates from computer science courses. Yet the department was actually increasing the number of visa grants to young 457 visa holders, and predominantly the growth was going to people from Indian companies, and their salaries were being approved at very low rates.
If Siew Ann Khoo, if I can come back to you on this issue of wages, there is a guaranteed minimum wage that 457 visa workers have to be paid, and they have to be paid at least the award wage. But that wage may often be well below the prevailing wage. Say if you're working on a remote mining site or something like that, you could actually command a much higher wage than what is on offer through this scheme.
Yes, the minimum wage is actually to ensure that the 457 visas are those with trade skills and professional skills, that they're not semi-skilled level. So that's the reason for imposing the minimum wage. But as like you said, the terms of sponsorship of these 457 visa holders is that employers should pay these foreign workers on the same basis as Australian workers, and that if they don't, then they're violating the conditions of sponsorship.
But that's not the rules, is it? The rules is that they pay this minimum, not that they pay market rates. I mean, an Australian worker may be able to command a much higher salary than that minimum set by the Immigration Department.
Well, they're supposed to be paying the same wages as they would pay an Australian worker. So if they're not, then the department has the right to impose sanctions or to take it up with the employer sponsor according to the terms of these visas.
Bob Kinnaird, that raises the other issue of how well regulated 457 visas are to see what's actually going on in the workplace.
That's right, Peter. And the answer to the question is, on the basis of the evidence that we have so far, the visa is not being very well regulated at all. What we do know is that the Department of Immigration sends a form out to every 457 employer over a period of 12 months, and they send the form back and tick the boxes and say, yes, I am paying the wage that I'm supposed to be paying according to the salary that DEMA approved when the visa was granted. And then in 25% of employers, the department actually makes so-called site visits and does some checking up on site. But once again, very, very little information is disclosed by the department about the results of those compliance monitoring exercises. Usually it has to be dragged out of the minister or the department via a question in Parliament. It's one thing to publish information on the number of visas, like 12 months after the event. But as far as the compliance monitoring exercise is concerned, it's very, very difficult to find out what's actually happening.
So should the 457 visa be scrapped or should it be reformed?
Well, in my opinion, it shouldn't be scrapped. It's an essential part of the armoury of a modern open economy, and it when it's operating properly, then it serves a very, very useful purpose. But it needs to be reformed, and it needs some serious reform, in my opinion. And the major reforms are that, number one, there needs to be much more information disclosed by the government about the program and how it's operating, so that the community at large can make informed judgments about what's happening. And number two, the program needs to require employers to pay market rates, not these administratively convenient minimum salaries that are specified for the visa.
Sue Ann Koo, do you think there need to be any changes to the 457 visa?
Well, I have no problems with what the Bob's suggestions. I think they're all very good, and that should really improve the way the visa has been implemented.
Okay, Bob Kinnaird and Sue Ann Koo, thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Bob Kinnaird, an independent migration and labour market analyst who's written on the 457 visa in the journal People and Place. And Dr. Sue Ann Koo is a demographer at the Australian National University and co-author of a study surveying the experiences of temporary workers in Australia. And I can't leave the topic of temporary workers without quoting this letter to the online news service Crikey. Suzanne wrote, "What do we think about bringing in some skilled politicians on working visas? There does seem to be a shortage of talented people out there, regardless of pay and conditions. We could install them in the various opposition parties around the country." And you can send us your comments on the 457 visa by writing a letter or by clicking on the Have Your Say button on the National Interest website. We look forward to hearing from you. You're listening to The National Interest on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, or as audio from our website. Last year, the mother of Olympic gold medal winner Cathy Freeman was forced to pay a funeral debt dating from the 1950s before she could bury her niece. She was told the burial couldn't happen until she settled the account for her grandmother's funeral. Over time, the debt had grown from £2.05 to almost $1,000. But by rights, that original funeral bill should have been paid by the Queensland Protector of Aborigines, which controlled most aspects of Aboriginal lives in the 1950s, including workers' salaries. Wages were held in trust for Aboriginal workers by the Queensland government, but many never saw their money again. It's known as the Stolen Wages story, and it's the subject of a new book by historian and activist Rosalind Kidd. Rosalind Kidd, welcome to the National Interest.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, for how many years were Aboriginal wages paid to the Queensland government rather than to the workers themselves?
Well, it was extraordinary. They started controlling the wages as early as 1904. And in fact, some wages were still controlled by the government into the 1980s. Officially, people could ask if they could control their own wages, I think, in the late 1960s. But it's quite obvious that many people either didn't hear that this was a possibility or, of course, were too intimidated to ask for that right.
And how did the government justify cashiering the wages of these workers?
Well, the idea, of course, was under this so-called protection regime. They said that workers could be cheated of their money either by the employers or by people who knew they had a bit of cash and could weasel it out of them. And so the government said, well, we'll give ourselves the power to just take control of the wages. Over the years, of course, this was a huge amount of money because there were 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people working. And I should say that the government contracted them out to work. You didn't have a choice of where you went and you didn't have a choice of what you were paid. And then, of course, finally, you didn't have a choice as to whether you actually got to see any of that money.
So in a sense, the Queensland government was like an employment broker. It was offering these workers to employers and then taking the wages on their
Absolutely.
Behalf.
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly how, and that's how they saw themselves. People who were removed against their will onto settlements, the younger children were trained to be workers and were sent out to work from the ages, well, supposedly from the age of 14, but we know many children much younger than that were also contracted out to work, as were adults right through their working life. You were never actually free from this system of forced indenture to work, nor were you in a position to negotiate your rate of pay. And nor, as we now know, were you even allowed to have your own money when you earned it.
So you couldn't quit and go and work for someone else?
Absolutely not.
And did this affect all Aborigines in Queensland?
About half of the Aboriginal population was under control of the Acts, as they termed it, which was about 7,000 or 8,000 people. But, of course, over the 70-year period, it has affected far more than that because it was generational. You've got people now whose grandparents, as Kathy Freeman's mother discovered, whose grandparents were controlled and didn't have their money. Their parents were controlled and didn't have their money. And there's many people living today who were also contracted out to work and didn't get their money. So it's a huge banking system. The problem that we find now from research that I've been doing in government files for the last 15 years is how badly that system operated.
Well, let's talk about what sort of work people were doing.
Just about everything, Peter. The pastoral industry was a huge employer. In fact, it would not have survived without Aboriginal labour. This was something that was stated year after year through the decades. And yet, amazingly enough, despite the fact that the pastoral industry and the government's agents themselves said Aboriginal workers were regarded far more highly in many cases than white workers, despite that fact, the government used to contract them at cheap rates, sometimes as low as 38% of the white wage. So as a broker and having a legal responsibility to protect the interests and further the interests of the Aboriginal people it controlled, the government actually failed in that duty by selling people out at a very cheap rate to the pastoral industry.
Didn't do a very good job of negotiating their wages then?
Didn't bother at all, and it makes you wonder about their priorities, of course. I mean, often the pastoral industry, the United Graziers Association, would lobby against wage rises, and often, as the files show, the government would cave in and not bother to implement them. But, of course, it wasn't only the stockmen. There were domestics. There were women and children, young girls, sent out to work as domestics, both in the cities and towns, but also into remote pastoral areas, which we know from their writings was an absolutely horrifying experience. You could have a girl of 12 from Palm Island who's never set foot on the mainland, just shipped across in the ferry and given into control of the local police at Townsville and then put on a train with almost no money and no clothing to go out to some remote pastoral property. Because of the remoteness of many of these jobs, the government always knew that it had no way of checking the level of abuse, the level of labour exploitation. Physical attacks were common. The conditions that even when they set minimum conditions in 1919, they had no way of enforcing them. And the reports kept coming in of the atrocious conditions and the atrocious treatment, and the government just basically shelved the reports and said, well, it's too expensive for us to have proper labour inspectors. So, again, what affronts me most about it is they knew at every point that the system was being abused and they just didn't bother to fix it.
Well, many of those Aboriginal girls and women who went out to work as domestic servants ended up getting pregnant. And then, of course, they suffered a salary cut because they had to look after their own children as well, so they were paid less.
That's right. Either the government had two ways of dealing with that. It either kept the baby on the settlement and just sent the mother out again to work and trained the baby up to follow her at a later date, or they would offer the baby to go with the mother at a cut rate. And you can read it in the annual reports where they will say, and of course the mothers and the children will benefit from, you know, the better food in the country and more milk and all this sort of stuff. But that is completely belied by reports from the protectors in the areas who would chronicle the abuses. There was a major scandal about this in the mid-1930s to do with an allegation made to the governor of Queensland, Governor Wilson, at that time, about the high percentage of young girls who were falling pregnant when they were sent out to work. And amongst those papers was the government calculating that it was more profitable to continue to send the girls out to work despite the assaults, because if they didn't send them out to work, firstly, they would not have control of their income, which was a major part of this whole program. And secondly, they said we'd have to pay for them, we'd have to feed and clothe them on the settlements. So it's quite a blatant expression of the priorities of the government, which was financial at every point as a priority, as against the well-being of the people it was supposed to protect.
Did the workers see any money? I mean, they must have got paid something for their living expenses.
Yes, well, I don't know that I'd go for living expenses. I think that's gilding the lily a little bit. But yes, in theory, people got a small amount of money during the work period, which was called pocket money. I shouldn't say small amount. It varied from person to person. It could have been up to 70%, but mostly it was about 20%.
20% of their wages?
Of the wage, yes. The rest of it went directly to the government agent, the police protector. But in terms of this pocket money section, which was introduced in about 1904, the government files show quite clearly that there was no way ever of knowing whether that money was paid. In fact, audit reports continually complained about it, and the last one that I found at the very end of the system, which was an audit report in 1964-65, said actually there's never been any system in place to ensure that this money was paid. Now, I have done calculations between 1920 to 1960, calculating the rate of wages on average and calculating a percentage, a sort of a middle range of this pocket money. And what you're talking about is hundreds of millions of dollars in today's money that the government knew was probably not being paid to these workers. And that was only one part of the system where the money was being lost.
Well, indeed. I mean, it's not just wages. And we talk about stolen wages. But in fact, the Queensland government also cashiered the child endowment payments, which came from the Commonwealth and were meant to be for Aboriginal families for their children.
Yes, it's incredible, Peter. I just couldn't believe it when I came across these documents. The child endowment was introduced in 1941 by the Commonwealth, and all the rhetoric around it, and quite obviously, it was meant to be an added payment to improve the health of babies and young children and the mothers. Now, as soon as that endowment became available, the Queensland government, and they weren't on their own, by the way, but the Queensland government did two things, at least. One of those was that the grants that they used to pay to the mission boards, the Presbyterian Mission Board and the Anglican Mission Board, those grants they just cut by the same amount as was being paid to the missions in child endowment. In other words, the government ended up tens of thousands of dollars ahead every quarter, and the missions were left struggling on exactly the same amount. So that was one way they commandeered the endowment. But the other thing they did do was they applied, in terms of the hundreds of mothers on the settlements, the government settlements, the government applied to the Commonwealth and said, well, we want to take this money in the first instance so that we can make sure that the mothers aren't wasting the money. But in fact, as the files quite clearly show, the government stockpiled that money in Palm Island at one point. They had the equivalent of $500,000 today stockpiled while the children were dying at 34 times the state, the white average in Australia, from malnutrition and pneumonia and diseases of neglect. The government also used child endowment for capital works. It was just an incredible abuse of the whole intent of the payment.
You're listening to The National Interest, and I'm talking to Dr. Rosalind Kidd about her new book, Trustees on Trial, Recovering the Stolen Wages. Rosalind Kidd, the Beattie government in Queensland has offered $55 million in compensation for the stolen wages. Is that offer adequate?
Not in any way, Peter. It's an insult on many grounds. It's an insult in terms of the amount of money. In fact, the Premier, in announcing that offer in Parliament in May 2002, he actually quoted my estimation that the amount owing could be at least $500 million. And he also said, we actually have no idea how much people might be owed. Now, for a government to offer $55 million may have been reasonable if they had not said that that is all you get, and to get that money you have to sign away all your legal rights.
That is, if you take the money, you can't sue us for any more. You can't take us
exactly.
to court.
Exactly. And when we say $55 million, it sounds quite a lot of money, but the amount in the breakdown came to $4,000 as a maximum for people who were over the age of 50 years of age and $2,000 for those under 50 years of age. And I should say, the government, just by the stroke of a pen, said, and anybody who is not alive at this point, May 2002, their money is gone forever.
So you know, descendants can't claim on behalf of
They were just excluded, yeah. So you've got people whose grandparents and parents may have died, and we know why people died young under the system, because they were so deprived of their cash to, you know, care better for themselves and their families. So those people, all that money remains with the government. Governments in Queensland have made hundreds of millions of dollars in today's terms out of their management of Aboriginal people.
Many claimants of these stolen wages didn't accept the Beattie government offer. They refused to accept it. They saw it as being, as you said, an insult. Does that mean that we're going to see legal action to reclaim this money?
I think we definitely will. I know there are many people at the moment talking with lawyers. We have a range of lawyers here in Queensland who are working pro bono. They're just dedicated to try and get justice on this. There has been already a couple of cases settled out of court for considerable amounts. People do not want to be forced into taking legal action. It is a long, drawn-out process, but they see themselves as having no choice. The point of my current book is to say that knowing what we do about how badly the Queensland government control people's money, negligence, incompetence, failure to implement changes that were recommended by auditors, etc., but also blatant mismanagement and misuse, I would like to see the government be accountable for what it had done. It is my feeling that no other financial institution with that sort of a record would be able to just say, well, we've given you a few dollars, you should feel grateful, and that's the end of it. And I think people from the Aboriginal community now are far more aware of what was going on, and they feel the same way. They want their own money back. It's as simple as that.
Rosalind Kidd, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Historian Dr. Rosalind Kidd, whose new book is called Trustees on Trial, Recovering the Stolen Wages. It's published by Aboriginal Studies Press and was launched on Thursday at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. And Queensland's not the only state or territory that has a history of stolen wages. At a national level, the issue is the subject of a current Senate inquiry, which is due to report in December. We'll put a link to the inquiry on the National Interest website. Coming up, pure water from the sun. You're listening to the National Interest on ABC Radio National. 2 weeks ago on the program, I spoke to British science writer Fred Pearce about the state of the world's rivers and underground water supplies. And one of the biggest problems he identified was water pollution. That interview prompted a very interesting email from Adelaide physicist John Ward, who's devoted his retirement to inventing a solar water purifier that can turn heavily polluted or saline water into a product that's fit to drink. John Ward, welcome to the National Interest.
Hello, Peter.
What led you to devote your energies to creating a solar water purifier?
A few years ago, I went on a holiday to Zimbabwe and was quite horrified about how many young children were dying from waterborne diseases. And I thought, there's an easy problem to solve. And when I got back to Australia, I wrote down all the parameters which I thought would be required to change dirty water into drinking water. And in no time at all, I realised it was very difficult and soon realised why it had not been done. Effectively, there were only two means available to mankind for purifying dirty water. One is called flash distillation, in which you boil water at reduced pressure. And the other one is reverse osmosis. Both of these are very costly, require very advanced technical people to operate them. And I thought, those two methods are no good. I'll go back to a very old-fashioned way, solar distillation.
You use the sun to distill the water and purify it?
Yes. This method's been used many times throughout mankind's history. And I saw some lovely pictures of one in Chile, which was built in 1884, producing about 100,000 litres of water a day. And this was concrete pits lined with tar, a local product, big tar pits there. And I thought, I'm sure I can improve upon that. And steadily, over the last decade or so, I have done just that.
And so how does your solar purifier work?
It's a black plastic box which has a top and a bottom, and it's hollow. And on top of the box is a piece of white glass. That's glass which doesn't have very much iron oxide in it, the rust. When you look along the side of a piece of glass, it's green. And it's green because of the iron oxide, the rust which is in it. And when you remove that rust, the glass costs a little bit more money, but it gets a new property. And the property is it transmits ultraviolet light quite well, while simultaneously transmitting the visible and the near infrared. The ultraviolet light goes through the glass, through the water, which is dirty inside, and breaks down the DNA bonds of the bacteria, algae and viruses, thereby killing them. The infrared light simultaneously goes through the glass and heats the water. The water evaporates and condenses on the underside of the glass surface, which is tilted at a small angle. It runs down the underside of the glass and is collected. And because of the rather unusual geometry of this system, it behaves as what they call an array of square section, short length heat pipes, and we get more than is theoretically possible. I recently went to an international solar energy conference in Sweden, and the man before me was a professor of hydrology from one of the Mexican universities, and very proudly he stood there with his huge cravat, bright green jacket and yellow trousers, and announced that the theoretical limit of pure water obtained from the sun was about 5.1 litres per square metre per day. They had achieved 4.8 litres per square metre per day in laboratory experiments, and he was very excited, and he left the stage to thunderous applause. I was the next speaker, and I announced that we routinely get 8, 9 and even 10 litres per square metre per day. And I was effectively mobbed after this and was interviewed and appeared on European television and the gadget, which I didn't have with me, I only had a photograph, was announced as potentially one of the future world beaters, and Rotary International have since picked me up, and without them I'd never have got as far as I have.
A key question, of course, John, is how much does it cost to make one of these things? Because obviously the potential use is in less developed countries. So how viable is it as a mass product that people can use in a widespread manner in poor countries?
At the moment, in Australia, where manufacturing costs are very high, if someone walked in off the street and said, I would like one of these, they're $350. And this one unit would provide a family with most of the pure water they wanted for drinking on a given day. However, if you bought 10 of these, the price would drop to about $280. If they were mass-produced in quite a big way, we have been told the manufactured price would be somewhere around $50. This is very exciting, and Rotary is dealing with Pakistan at the moment. We've sent several of these things over there, and these people are making the frames which support the panels in the first stage of this operation. And in the second stage, we hope they will be making these things over there so they can get pure water for themselves directly from the sea. It is ideal in every way for processing seawater.
What about contaminated water? I mean, on the program a couple of weeks ago, Fred Pierce talked about the problems in Bangladesh with arsenic in groundwater, about the problems of excessive fluoride in some water in South India. Can your device deal with those sorts of problems?
Yes, indeed it can. We have had water laced with normal acceptable levels of arsenic by WHO standards, World Health Organization. We've then had the level increased to 10, 50 and 100 times the acceptable level. And in every case, we're able to completely remove the arsenic. And not only can we remove it, we can separate it out from the water and have it as a byproduct. So this is particularly valuable if you have a mine where you are producing, say, uranium, uranium oxide, yellowcake, they call it round here. And we can separate the pure water from the water containing the uranium. And when this is produced in Bangladesh in the form mainly of arsenic trisulfide, this can be mixed with sand and cement and cast into bricks and used for building purposes, and thereby becoming most innocuous and not harmful in any way to the people. So we're quite excited about that. And we paid a great deal of money to have water laced with all sorts of things like Legionella, Salmonella, Giardia, Escherichia coli, Cryptosporidium, lots of the well-known diseases, which germs which carry these diseases, give them to people when they drink the water. And especially is it useful, potentially, in Bangladesh. We only have a couple over there working at the moment, and hopefully, in the near future, there'll be a lot more.
Another question, John, is could you use this on a very large scale? I mean, we know that in Perth they're building a desalination plant. They're talking about it in Sydney. They're doing it in Brisbane. Could you make a mass one of your devices to provide water for a city from the sun?
At this stage, I would say the answer to that is no. However, we were slowly inching our way forwards to that target. We typically put an array of these things, which at the moment are only a third of a square meter in area. And by making an area around 4 square meters, we can produce amounts of water varying between about 20, 30 and 50 or 60 litres per day. And for a small community, that's a valuable input to their pure water supply. However, we can have lots of these, and we're contemplating an array of arrays, each array consisting of 12 panels, which will produce around 10,000 litres of water per day. However, en route to this, one day I was playing around and didn't have enough panels to do the experiment with, and I just put one on top of the other and another one on top of that, forming a kind of sandwich. And lo and behold, when I was using this sandwich and introducing hot water to it, I found something out which was very exciting. If I was to stack 25 of these panels on top of each other and had a supply of hot water, such as can be obtained from the effluent from a power station at temperatures of 60 degrees centigrade or more, it would be possible in a small room, something, a shed, say 10 or 12 meters square, with sets of these things, 25 on top of each other with a small gap between them, to produce potentially hundreds of thousands of litres a day. But you would necessarily need a supply of hot water to do that.
What about things like maintenance and cleaning, and how long does the device actually last before it needs to be replaced?
Typically, there are no chemicals, no moving parts, no filters, and no electronics, and providing you keep it wet, it doesn't need cleaning. I've had one working in my backyard for about 4 years now, and apart from it looking slightly more matte in appearance as opposed to being specularly shiny to start with, it's performing quite well. So you do not have to clean them if you keep them wet. Once a day in the morning, you flush your dirty water through, that cleans it. Let the sun do its work. Remove the pure water and flush it again the next day. The anticipated life, we're not 100% sure of that. We've contacted the plastic providers and they assure us it's somewhere between at least 7 and 10 years.
And John, how much of your superannuation has gone into this project?
Every single cent.
And do you expect to retire a second time very wealthy from this? No.
My major objective was totally humanitarian, and I'm thrilled to bits that Rotary International have picked me up. They searched around the world to find the best means of producing pure water from dirty water, and this was selected from several hundreds which were submitted. We've now got them in 18 countries. We've got Rotary to assemble these things. They buy in the components with their own money, assemble them to our specification. Then they give them away to people in developing countries. And this pleases me, and we get a very small royalty for doing that. But I think the stage is now set for somebody to come along commercially and say, we would like to manufacture that, distribute it, and sell it. And that's not my particular forte. I'm rather much more interested in developing things and finding out why things work or don't work than I am in selling things, which is a very specialist art, and I simply don't have it.
John Ward, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Retired physicist John Ward. And keep an eye out for John Ward, his business partner Margaret Folkhard, and their solar water purifier on ABC TV. They'll be appearing soon on the New Inventors program. Over the coming week, Radio National is travelling back in time to revisit the big events of 1956. On the National Interest, we'll be discussing a less spectacular event from 50 years ago, the first licensing of poker machines in pubs and clubs. I'm Peter Mayers. Thanks for your company.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.